Hey everyone, Bina 007 here from Vassals of Kingsgrave. I'm about to vollop volley mo volley from the forums and Jock, Monroe Jock 2. If you're not aware of the sort of format of this, it's inspired by basically steals from the amazing podcast The Dollop, which if you like American history, you should check out, by two comedians, one of whom gives a story from history and the other one has to react to it. So that's kind of the format today. The topic is going to be quite brutal because it's about a spree killer. So if you're of a sensitive disposition, please exercise self-care and do not listen further. Even if you do listen, you know, sometimes we're going to relieve the tension by laughing, but we want to make it clear that we have nothing but the utmost respect for the victims in this crime and their families. So with that, please listen on.
Ooh, 69.
It was the summer of 69. Or was it the summer of 63? I forget. Andrew Phillip.
It was 69 for sure.
Yeah, what's the Bryan Adams song? Is that the summer of 69, right?
When I bought my first six string down at the five and dime. Played it till my fingers bled. Was the summer of 69.
That's such a fucking great song. Okay, it was also the year in which Andrew Philip Cunanan is born in National City, USA. He is the son of Modesto Pete Cunanan. What a great name.
Modesto Pete?
Modesto Pete.
Okay.
His dad, who's quite the character. Born in the Philippines, he basically, as a teenager, decides to just leave Manila, shows up in the US and enlists in the Navy.
Sure.
And he's kind of one of these go ahead, get ahead kind of guys. He wants to, you know, live the American dream. And so he kind of meets, when he's in his, I believe, early 30s, this like hot young Italian American called Mary Ann Scalacci, I think is how you pronounce it.
Scalacci.
Scalacci.
If you put it in post, maybe it sounds good.
SCH.
So he wants to make money and bang bitches.
Yeah, but he knocks her up, though, so he has to marry her. And I think that kind of, yeah, it's not the ideal entrepreneurial match, because she quickly bangs out four kids, being Italian, very Catholic, and he quits the Navy. He wants to become a stockbroker, because he has the whole greed
instinct. It's not a weird path for that.
Yeah, exactly. So he does, I didn't know this was a thing, like stockbroking exams or something. But he lives in San Diego, and he gets a job with Merrill Lynch, which I guess at the time is sort of, you know.
Hey, they're my financial brokers. They sent me a birthday card.
They send you. That's they give you sucky card. Advice, though, man, because you're always bitching about how you're down X percent.
You know, we got into something recently and immediately dropped 14%. You know, these things happen.
The moral of this story, the moral of the tale of Modesto Pete, is that you should definitely check they're not skimming your account.
Oh, they're definitely, well, they're not skimming my account. They're just not making any good money on it.
Okay. Well, anyway, he basically switched job every 2 years because he was kind of nicking money from his clients to finance not so much a lavish lifestyle for him, but for his beloved younger son. The younger son is called Andrew, and for whatever bizarre reason...
And was he born in 1969?
He was born in 1969. And for whatever reason, the parents decide to just utterly pin all their hopes of glory on this young son. They give him everything he wants. So when he's 14 and he can't even drive yet, and he can't attend some school trip because he's sick, his dad just goes out and buys him a sports car.
No, oh, like you do.
Yeah.
So wait a minute. The first three kids got the shaft, and Andrew gets all the everythings.
Yeah, it's not immediately clear why either. Like, it's not like they did something wrong, or yeah.
Huh.
I mean, okay. Can you imagine the family dynamic? They even give him the master suite in the house, like the master
that's
bedroom.
Weird. That's real weird. Was there any, like, was the father taking any special privileges with the kid? Like, what is going on?
Not apparently, no, although you would suspect. But even the mum smothered him, and apparently he just grew to believe he was, you know, life's special little flower, and he would order his mum around. I think the dad was handsy with the mum. So
Sexually in front of him, or like abusively in front of him?
I think physically abusive. And Andrew escaped into books, which I sympathize with. So he's like smart, he's like got a good IQ. But he also, as well as being smart and reading, his books, he also reads Vogue and Vanity Fair and Architectural Digest. So he's acquiring tastes that are maybe above his parents' income.
Well, he just got a sports car for nothing, so I don't know if that's true, but it's still a weird, like, this guy's setting up to be a very maladjusted human being.
Well, to be clear, like, the dad can't afford the sports car. He's nicking money from his clients to finance it. So whatever, so basically it's like a lower middle class income or middle income household. It's just that if you devoted every single cent that you're earning and nicking into this one kid, then he can have a very nice lifestyle, but no one else is having a very nice lifestyle, I guess.
Wow.
But just
All
imagine what that does to you.
right.
Like, even if you're well balanced, I mean, what signals are you being given as a kid?
Oh my God, he's going to be Norman Bates.
Exactly. It's kind of interesting to me though, because like a lot of we did our Mind Hunter podcast, and a lot of the kind of messages of that is like, if you want to create a serial killer, be a terrible mom, bully your kid, call him a sissy. But this is almost the opposite. It's like, smother them with love and kindness. And it's not love, is it, just to spoil them that badly? But
I wonder, do we find out if he's homosexual or something that goes against like the strict rigid religious norms or the
he is indeed homosexual.
maybe they were trying to like buy him out of being homosexual.
I'm not sure, because I'm not sure at that age they even knew. Like, I mean, this spoiling started way before then. And he was, like, to all intents and purposes, as a young kid, just being a good Catholic schoolboy. He was an altar boy. So I'm not sure they wouldn't necessarily have been trying to bribe him out of that necessarily. And in fact, even when he was very campy in his late teens, they didn't seem to not love him for that. Like, I think they might have just, like, deep buried, ignored it or whatever. But
Interesting.
so at the age of nine, in 1981, so at this point he is 12, he gets into this really tony private school called the Bishop School in, I think you pronounce it, La Jolla in San Diego, which is going to be this like really flash part of San Diego. So then this is, I think, really where it starts to go horribly wrong, because he's in this school where everyone is super rich and he's like the scholarship kid, and his parents are like spending every penny they have to keep him there and keeping him in his uniforms. But he's just with kids who are going on ski holidays and are going on holidays to Europe. And
Oh, no. I'm feeling like I'm already building resentment against these kids.
yeah, I mean, like, this is very much my experience of being the scholarship kid at private school. So I get how you can get jealous and resentful, and
I was a scholarship kid at a public school.
yeah, I mean, you can never fit in, right? You can, I remember being at school and we would have like one cheapo holiday a year to some place close, like Spain, and they would be like, every Christmas, oh, this year we're going to Barbados, this year we're going to, St. Lucia, and you'd be like, oh, fuck off, so I get that. I get that it's tough being the poor kid in school. But his reaction was, rather than just dealing with it, and that's part of growing up, I guess, he just becomes a massive liar.
Cool.
Cool. So he just never brings kids home. He lies. He says that his dad is like this Filipino plantation owner. And it, like, the story has changed. So sometimes his dad owns plantations. Sometimes he's a famous Filipino general working for the Marcoses. Sometimes his mum is a famous Italian, owns an edit a publishing company. Sometimes they're in trouble with the mafia and he's on the run, so he has to be very private. There's a real kidnapping threat because his parents are so rich. I mean, like, the lies just are ridiculous.
Dude, the mafia story is the one to play, right? Because then you'd just be like, nah, I can't tell you.
Yeah,
Or if I.
exactly. And he did use that a lot. So it's kind of interesting to me that he would go to that option. And what was really funny is that all through his life, but even at school, people kind of knew he was lying, but they kind of didn't want to call him out on it because they thought it might be hurtful. And he just sort of feel, if someone had just said, dude, stop lying, we know, like, you're not kidding anyone, that might have, and as humiliating as that would have been, it might have done him some favors, I think. But anyway.
Yeah, but then he just snaps and then he like goes and takes it out on everyone at school.
Yeah, but like, the earlier you snap, the more limited that taking it out on is going to be one way.
Don't know about that, but yeah, I feel like if he got called out, I feel like already like he's getting set up to be like that weird kid in school who like thinks like who says like I don't know. Did you have one of those kids in your grade where it's like, oh yeah, home, I have blank and blank and blank, and you're like, dude, you don't have any of that stuff. Like, if you had all those three gaming systems or something, like, you'd be a much happier person and wouldn't want to tell anyone about it.
But that's the sad thing, isn't it? Because it does come from unhappiness and insecurity. So at this stage, I do kind of have some sympathy for him because I think I have sympathy with that of being in that social situation where you're desperately trying to compete. But at the same time, he'd do dickish stuff. Like he was trying to impress this girl who wouldn't go on a date with him. So he said, well, let's have a date in the cafeteria at lunch. And while all the kids are eating their normal lunches, he gets his mum to go to this flash restaurant down in the town and bring a lobster dinner in and pass it over the school gates and like unravels this huge lobster dinner picnic in front of her, much to
That's a
her.
big move.
I mean, like, how mortifying is that? Even if you like the guy, it's just mortifying. Who does that?
Yeah, it's a big move. I hope she put out. I hope it was worth it.
But he wouldn't have wanted because he already knows he's gay, and he's becoming.
Then why is he doing that for the girl?
I think he just wants to be flash, or I think he wants to be loved, and this is a buying people's love is something that becomes a theme. But he's actually quite interestingly, I think, for someone who's so desperate to fit in, he is quite camp. Like he doesn't hide that he's gay. He's quite flamboyant. He loves talking about fashion design. He's obsessed with Mercedes-Benz cars. He's fabulosity. So he's not trying to be under the radar or fit in terms of sexuality. And this is the late 80s. I mean, this is like the AIDS crisis period, right? So.
Whoa, wait a minute. so we went from materials to AIDS. What happened there? Did
We
he
went
have
from what
AIDS?
to. No. I'm just saying that if
I
you're in
thought
a.
it was going to be like the, it was the 80s. It was like the me generation, the consumer generation, like,
I think, yeah, he
flashy.
reflects that. He's very Patrick Bateman yuppie, like, or wannabe yuppie. Like, he's.
So, but you said AIDS,
No, I just said
so
that it's
that's
kind
the
of weird that
problem.
he's in a conservative place like San Diego. If he were trying to fit in, the decision to be very campy and out about your gayness is quite a brave thing because this would have been the height of homophobic time, right? So like
Right.
if he joined school at 12 at 81, so by 18 it's like, 86, 87, that would not have presumably been a good time to be a gay teenager who's already campy.
Yeah, maybe even earlier too, like 85,
Yeah.
84.
Good run. It's time to give it up.
Jack comes barreling into the podcast.
Hey, Jock.
Sorry, I didn't notice, sir.
Okay, so to catch you up, we're talking about Andrew Cunanan. It's the late 80s. He's in a very private, exclusive school, but he's the scholar, he's the poor kid, but he's covering it up with lies and trying to pretend to fit in. But he's also being quite campy about his being gayness, so he obviously doesn't want to fit in that badly. And he's trying to buy people's affection with flashiness, which is going to be a theme. Okay, so as you get to the end of your preppy private school, obviously everyone's applying to college, right?
Or university.
Yeah, exactly. And you might have thought that he would be, because he's like boasted all his life about how, he wants to go to an Ivy or a very exclusive university. But it must obviously, despite his delusions, be clear to him his dad can't afford to pay for that. So he's always very kind of vague and ambiguous about where he's going to go to university. Now he
It
could
sounds
just.
like Dad needs to skim a little more money.
Well, exactly. His elder sister just goes because the UC system is quite subsidized, right? So she just goes to UC San Diego, I think, and gets a really good degree. So he could just do that. But for our Andrew, that's not going to be enough, right? He'll want to go to a Princeton or a Harvard. Or.
I think even back then, UC system may have been free for UC residents.
Yeah, exactly. But it like I say, it's not exclusive enough. And although he's bright, like he has an IQ of 147 tested.
Jesus.
I know, but he's just lazy. Like he thinks life should just give it to him. So he's not working hard so he might get a scholarship to an Ivy. Like he just doesn't have the grades.
Which is funny because I think mid-80s is when the Working Hard for the Money song came out.
He's also dabbling in light drugs at this point, but
Ooh.
nothing too serious. But
In San
apparently.
Diego back then, that was like just the beginning of like, the good push of like weed and heroin and meth through from Mexico.
Oh yeah, absolutely. We're gonna believe you me, we're gonna get into that.
Oh, yay.
Fun. So he's kind of 18. He's drifting a little bit. He doesn't have the grades, doesn't have the money, but he has exquisite taste. And his dad, basically having nicked all this money to finance his private school education, literally sells the house out from under Andrew and his mum and buggers off back to Philippines.
That is another big move.
It's a ballsy move.
Yeah.
Who does that? I mean, who literally sells the house out from underneath your kids?
I mean, if you're gonna like split, that's splitting. That's see ya, bye.
Wow.
Bye bye.
So actually, he's also like a pretty cool character in his own right. He goes to the Philippines, and apparently, I didn't realize this. There's this whole like mythological thing about how the Japanese during the Pacific War left a
Hit
whole
gold.
bunch of gold. Yes.
Yes, Hirohito's treasure or something like that.
I did not know this. So what did you know about this? Like, what is it?
So just apparently, like, throughout the islands that they would hide, conquered gold and shit like that they had, like, just kind of hidden in like secret caves and shit like that in the mountains. And then when they were forced to retreat, they retreated too rapidly and had to leave some behind. And yeah, hold on. I'm gonna go on mute so I can type and look this up. Go on.
Okie dokie. So the father's fucked off, and the mum and the younger son, Andrew, then end up in like really shitty accommodation. And you can imagine that for a guy who had the master bedroom and the sports car and the nice clothes, the preppy clothes, that must have been quite the shock. So he does enroll at UC San Diego in 1987 in American history. But he can't really settle down because he's just really lazy, and he doesn't see why he should have to do something as ordinary as just work for a degree. So after a year, he drops out and he moves to the Castro District of San Francisco, which is obviously a center of gay culture.
Oh, yeah, that's like the epicenter.
Absolutely. And basically, I think he decides that he's so witty and he's so well read and so cultured that he is going to find a very super rich, gay older man who is going to keep him in the manner to which he feels he should become accustomed.
Sugar daddy.
Sugar daddy. And in the
I'm
intervening
still
month,
looking for one. Sugar
exactly.
mama or sugar daddy.
Exactly, doesn't sound like bad to me. So and in the kind of months up to that, he just sort of has a bunch of sex and gets into some porn that becomes increasingly more sort of leather and S&M, and starts taking drugs and gets a little bit into, at this point, probably just normal cocaine, up from like the pod and whatever. So a nice designer upmarket, posh drug like cocaine. Like, he's at this point, he's not doing anything quite as lowbrow as crystal meth.
Pure Peruvian blow.
Exactly.
Nothing like snorting that off a bare ass of a man. That came out wrong. Sorry, cut that.
He obviously he has a lot of money, and it's kind of controversial as to whether he's, before he finds his proper sugar daddy, whether he's got other rich men who maybe give him big checks, American gigolo style. But what is kind of, I don't know who's
Big
in
checks.
big check. Checky checky. So during this period, he like has a lot of money, but he doesn't keep any of it because he spends it all on flashy clothes. But also, he's incredibly generous. So he'll pick up the tab for drinks, he'll pick up the tab for lunch and dinner, and tip everyone because, and not so much because he wants to be nice to people, but because he wants to be seen as the big guy. The
That'll
flashy.
get you in trouble.
I will get you. And also because it fits in with his mythos of like having these New York millionaire parents or whatever it is. Like, he changes his story. Like, at one point, he starts claiming that he's Jewish because he thinks that'll be fashionable, and that
Huh.
half Jewish, and that he married some
Half
Jewish American
Filipino, half
princess.
Italian Jew.
Yeah, and that he got married really early to this very rich Jewish woman. They had a kid, but now he can't see the kid, and that's already tragic. I mean, it's just insane. And he starts using another name. He starts calling himself Andrew De Silva, because I don't think he's really proud of his Filipino kind of heritage, so he thinks maybe it'll be more.
Did he think De Silva was a Jewish last name?
No, this is like he has, this is the thing with him. He has all these different stories, and they're all contradictory, and they're all like badly done. Like, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out he's lying.
Jesus.
Yeah. And he gets more mean to his mum, like if she doesn't do what he wants. Like, apparently once they had this argument and he threw her against a wall and dislocated her shoulder.
Dislocated what?
Her shoulder.
Oh.
Yeah. And he's
Well.
working, like, all this time when he's claiming he's this super big shot guy, he's working at a freaking thrifty drugstore.
Well, now next time mom will remember to cut the goddamn crust off the bread, right?
Exactly. I mean, what a charmer. What an absolute freaking charmer. But at the thrifty drugstore, he obviously can steal prescription drugs and starts either doing them or doling them out and selling them. And basically, he starts becoming a drug dealer at this point. So, to your point on San Diego becoming a place where
Cool.
drugs are available to both buy and sell. So charming. Basically, highly narcissistic, a delusional fantasist.
Are you talking about Trump now, or are you just talking, or are we talking
Indeed. Okay.
what?
So during this period, he meets a guy called Norman, who is a super rich older guy who's grieving for his recently deceased partner, who he really loved from
Holy
AIDS.
shit. I'm imagining this guy literally has like cartoon dollar signs as eyes right now.
And basically, Andrew hits the big time. I mean, this guy keeps him for a year and buys him everything he wants and expensive suits. And he has like an Amex card that he just, can spend shitloads of money on. And he takes him on holidays to Europe. And really, if Andrew just like shut up and be nice, that could have been his life. And at the same time, he gets two different boyfriends who he kind of falls in love with. The first is a guy called Jeff Trail, who is this really wholesome naval officer who went to Annapolis. And it's just like a really good, straight-laced, really lovely guy. But he kind of leaves the Navy because it's that whole Clinton don't ask, don't tell period. And
Okay.
he's gay and he just feels he's getting horribly bullied and he just feels like he can't have a career. Like he's not getting promoted. So even though he's not out, Jeff kind of feels like people know and he can't have the. So he's like really sad. Like his whole family is military and he wants to be military and he's in the closet with his family and in the Navy and it's just really sad.
Jesus.
Yeah, and he's at a ship that's in San Diego, so that's how he meets
Sure.
our hero, who introduces him to the
Hero?
protagonist, who
Okay.
introduces he introduces young Jeff to the gay lifestyle and where to find nice young men, and I think he genuinely does help Jeff out. I think Jeff is in a very bad way, and Andrew shows him there's an alternative lifestyle, but. So that's one guy. And then he also meets another really kind of clean-cut, wholesome, lovely, simple, not bullshitting guy called David Madsen, who at the time, I don't think he's an architecture student yet. He's kind of a little bit drifting as to what he wants to do. He's from Minneapolis, again, in the closet with his family. Like these are kind of small town boys, right? And they just see this very suave, they buy it. They kind of buy the bullshit at first. But Jeff's the first one. Jeff does want to like have Andrew as a boyfriend, but just realizes there's all the lies and like, if you're trying to date someone but they never give you a home address, they never tell you where you can call them, it just becomes wearing. And I think someone as straightforward as Jeff Trail just wants someone to be honest and straightforward with him, maybe.
Yeah, that's like playing it massively on the down low.
Yeah. So by the important point of this story, which we're getting to, Jeff and Andrew are mates, they're friends, they're on a friendship tip. I think Jeff does owe him some money, but basically they're kind of friends, but Jeff has realized the truth of the lies. And whereas David Madsen still kind of finds Andrew to be very interesting, but is realizing that when they have sex that Andrew's maybe into some kind of S&M stuff that and there's nothing wrong with it as long as you're both consenting, and he's definitely not, and some of it's pretty extreme, so basically, it's not going to be a successful relationship, but Andrew thinks he's totally in love with David. He thinks David is the love of his life and that he's the guy he's going to settle down with, and he's his one chance at happiness. And, Why are you
This is
saying,
where the rug
oh
gets
no?
pulled out from under him.
Why are you saying, oh no? You don't know what's going to happen. Maybe they end up happily ever after.
It doesn't, I don't think we'd be talking about it if that was the case.
No, that is not the case. So basically, he's got Norman for money, he's got David for his dreams, and Jeff is a best mate. And in
Ooh,
effect,
trifecta.
trifecta. And within a month, basically, he loses all three. He's
Stool.
basically just a little shit to Norman. He just starts demanding more and more money, and he wants to be written into the will, and blah, blah, blah. And Norman's just like, look, you're not worth it. I'm getting rid of you.
Huh.
Like he storms out of Norman's houses and said and expects Norman to beg him to come back, and Norman doesn't. He's like, oh, okay. And then David
because
Madden.
there's not like a number of like young gay men who like a sugar daddy, and he's like, no, I'm the only one. You'll want me back.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the arrogance. That's the narcissism. Like, he can't realize, or he doesn't realize that he's actually in the lesser situation. He thinks Norman's lucky to have him. And it's like, who are you? Just some like 21-year-old mooch, you know? Like, there's nothing special about you at this point. Well, not 21, probably mid to late 20s at this stage. And then David Madsen tells him, you know, like, I'm really sorry, but we're not going to be together. We're just, you know, this isn't the relationship that's going to work out. And then Jeff.
So was this? So David was the one that was objecting to the S&M kind of increasing?
Yes. Well, even starting, let alone increasing. And also, I just think, again,
was spanking like a man.
And also, I think was like a straightforward guy and just wanted someone to be honest with him, as did Jeff. And then Jeff tells him that he's moving to Minneapolis to get a job in a factory. And Andrew immediately thinks that therefore Jeff and David must be seeing each other, because David lives in Minneapolis and is becoming an architect. So, which is not true. I mean, Jeff and David are friends, but they're not dating. There's no evidence they're dating. So, but you can just see the paranoia. He loses his sugar daddy. He loses the guy who he thinks is going to be the man of his dreams and his best mate. And he just sees it as betrayal everywhere.
Yeah.
How it's all
do you
about
have
him,
those
right?
Three people being different people and thinking like, "Nah, that's okay."
But it speaks to the total kind of like narcissism that maybe, you know, maybe Jeff is just leaving because he's miserable. He's left the Navy. He doesn't have a job, and he just wants to go where there's a job. Like, it doesn't always have to be about you, Andrew. But, you know, apparently it does. So they leave, the three people leave, and Andrew now basically has no money, a whole bunch of American Express card debt. He's dealing harder drugs, and he's taking harder drugs, and this is when he starts injecting crystal meth.
Injecting crystal meth, that's a big move too, yeah.
Yeah, and apparently, I don't know much about it, but that comes with a certain level of aggressive psychotic behavior with it if you start abusing it.
I don't think you can, like, even abuse it. I think you just shoot up crystal meth and kind of tweak out for a number of hours. All right, well.
So he is a tweaker. And basically just becomes a bit slobby, puts on a little bit of weight. And this is going to be important because a lot of people's memories of him and photos of him, he actually doesn't look like that anymore. Like, rather than the clean cut, preppy looking, slim, suave, he like does a buzz cut, puts on a bit of weight, becomes a bit schlubby. You know, he's like a hardcore drug dealer at this point and drug user. And gets more and more and more angry.
It's also impressive that he's able to put on weight while you injecting crystal meth, because that's not one of the things that I'm aware that is common.
Apparently he's just always eating Fritos. No offense to Frito eaters. And he's doing, apparently he's using increasingly and brutally violent porn, like not just normal S&M fetish, which is all great, but just like really extreme kind of, you know, punishment porn where you're sort of like latex masking someone and like restricting their air supply, you know.
Like, I don't like it.
I don't like it either. Some people do, and that's all good as long as it's consensual, right? But yeah.
No, but even still, that's the porn that leads into like the German guy like being like bound up and being eaten by another guy because it turned him on.
You can see how things would get out of hand.
Ugh, like some snuff bullshit. Ugh.
Yeah. But we should be clear, not everyone who's into S&M is into snuff, right? So
I'd hope not.
Yeah, exactly. So now we get to the point where Andrew Cunanan is 27. He believes that there was a beautiful, glittering life that he has been denied unfairly, of designer clothes and beautiful cars and, you know, holidays to Europe and flying first class. And he just looks like a piece of shit. And he's
me and him both.
Exactly. And he's been betrayed by his best friends in Minneapolis. So, April 1997.
April 1997.
Yeah, think about the period. Andrew Cunanan flies with a one-way ticket to Minneapolis, having thrown a farewell dinner in San Diego, and shows up on the doorstep of Jeffrey Trail and David Madsen, who are living separately. Neither of them really wants to put him up for the weekend. They're kind of, you know, like when you've moved on and you've got a new life and some guy just shows up. But because he previously was very generous to them, they kind of feel like they can't, like, turn their back on him.
A couch for a night is not too big of an ask, I feel like.
Yeah.
On a separate note, I feel like in April 1997, I was going to a punk show with my girlfriend at the time, and we got caught drinking vodka in the back of a car by the cops. And this girl happened to be my chemistry teacher's daughter, and the rest of the semester was very awkward.
What happened? Did he ever like explicitly tell you stuff, or was it just like that kind of passive aggressive, we both know but we're not going to say it, but you're never going to
No,
get
it
higher?
was a woman.
Oh,
Her
okay.
mother was my chemistry teacher. No, I actually ended up getting the best grades in that class out of my grade. So
Oh wow, okay.
it was much to her chagrin because she would try to catch me, like, because I used to play like baseball on my graphing calculator. dating myself a lot right now. yeah, and she'd just be like, "Matt, are you paying attention?" And then, like, right before the final, me and a bunch of buddies drank like an entire bottle of vodka. And she's like, "I hope you don't have a hard time concentrating." I'm like, "Oh my God, she knows that I'm like hammered and I'm about to take this test." Still got like a 98 on it.
That's just showing
It
off.
was easy.
That's just being a dickhead. Anyway, from what, let's get back to Andrew Cannon. So it's Minneapolis, it's 1997. He's pissed off and he's convinced Jeffrey and David are sleeping together, and that if Jeffrey hadn't moved in on his man, that his man would still be with him. So he basically goes to Jeffrey's place, steals his 40 caliber pistol that he has,
Oh, no.
and tells him that he needs to come pick it up from David's flat. So he's in the flat with David. Jeffrey turns up. He basically kills Jeffrey in an
Oh.
unprovoked attack with a claw hammer, the claw part of the hammer. Just whacks him and whacks him. I think it's on like 26 time. Just bashes
Oh.
his face in.
His face.
It's really a brutal, personal,
Yeah.
vengeful, passion-filled murder.
But I mean, if you're Jeff, like, you get that phone call, "I stole your gun, come get it." You don't go get
What do you do if you're a responsible
it.
middle American Jeff who thinks I need to get this gun back into safety?
No, you call the cops. You don't go to that meetup unless you're packing, but I
No,
don't
which he
think so.
was not. I think it's just no matter how much. I mean, at this point, Jeffrey knows he's a liar and a narcissist, but I don't think he thinks he's violent. Because actually, Jeffrey's a naval guy. He was in the US Navy. He thinks he can handle himself. And Andrew's this shorter, slimmer, sort of, quite never done any kind of physical exertion guy in his life. I mean, I don't think this is something Jeffrey would have thought was remotely a possibility.
Yeah, but he's tweaked out on meth, like he'll do anything.
But this is something I'm kind of interested in. Do Jeffrey and David really know that he's tweaked out on meth?
They got to. That's not something you hide.
And also, do they know how desperate he is in terms of his financial situation? Like, they know he lies about how rich he is, but do they really realize just like how indebted he is? And I don't think they knew it was a one-way ticket. In other words, this was a sort of last chance thing. So anyway, Jeffrey gets his face bludgeoned. It's a
Yeah, it
brutal
does.
murder.
What'd you say? 27 times? Oy.
David's just standing there in shock, watching this guy who has declared his love for him bludgeon his best friend, or their mutual best friend, in his
Yeah.
flat, and is just utterly like freaking out. David coolly, sorry, Andrew coolly calmly rolls up Jeffrey's body in a rug and puts it behind a sofa, but there's blood fracking everywhere in this flat.
Right.
And David's
Well,
like,
someone was watching him.
pardon?
Oh, this while someone was watching him.
Yeah, David Madsen's in the flat. David Madsen's petrified to leave because at this point Andrew's got he's got the gun, so he's got a gun on him. And
He's
David's
just
like,
standing there in shock,
and David's
like,
pleased, like,
yeah.
can we call the police? And Andrew's like, well, it's your flat. They'll think you did it. You'll be complicit. I'll say that you were that you were involved. But even then, I think David
Shit.
does want to turn himself. Then I mean, David thinks he's going to die at this point.
Yeah,
Anywho,
it's going to.
so. Basically, Andrew leaves the flat with David. David is very much being coerced at this point. They take off in David's car from Minneapolis and they're heading towards Chicago via Minnesota. And no one really knows what happens to trigger this, or what precisely even the timeline is. The cops have a real trouble with the timeline here. But effectively, David Madsen is found by Rush Lake near Rush City, Minnesota, on May 3rd, 1997, which is 6 days later. And he's basically been just shot in the back, in the head, and he's dead. So
wait a minute, it took him 6 days to drive like south in Minnesota?
Well, no, that's when the body was discovered. So it's not like people are very confused about how quickly David was killed. Did David ever have a chance? Did David try and escape? Did David just think, look, I can't live coerced like this, he may as well just get it over with and kill me? We don't know, right? We don't know.
I would think that he was like, I better just get it over with, kill me.
I mean, how horrific, though. What a way to go. I mean, I think you're better off being Jeff, and just being killed immediately.
Yeah, yeah, because, I mean, imagine, like, I mean, I have anxiety anyway, but, like, imagine, like, extending that for, like, 6 days, like, thinking you're going to get killed, like, thinking, like, this guy's going to kill me. Just do it. Get it over with. I'd rather live with that anxiety.
And at this point, at first they think that the police now have found this body in a rug. They think it's David at first. They won't enter the flat without a warrant, and that takes like delays everything, because this is now in the shadow of OJ Simpson, right? So now everyone's paranoid that unless they're scrupulous with warrants and evidence, nothing's going to hold up in court.
Right.
So they don't find out that it's Jeff that's dead for a while, and then David becomes a suspect. Everyone's like looking for David as the killer.
Right.
So it's only when David is killed, like, okay, so he's obviously not the killer, but he might still have killed Jeff, right? So his poor parents are having to find out, A, that their son is gay, which they didn't realize.
He's dead.
He might have still killed, like, the police are playing it as like this homosexual love triangle. It's not massive in the press, but it would have been in the local press. And you can imagine small town people, how hard that would be to take, and oh, what a nightmare.
That's what happened with Dahmer too. He got away with it because they're just like, oh, it's a gay thing, like, well, let the lovers like figure it out. But that was in Minnesota too.
I think there is some home, like some low-level homophobia here and how it's all treated at this point. And we can get to later. I think there's, it does play.
Come on, Minnesota. Get your shit together.
But also the fact that these murders happen in different places, and then you get into like jurisdictional issues, like which, who gets the evidence, who gets to be first in the trial, you know, it's the whole thing as a clusterfuck. So at this point, Andrew has killed the two men who he most closely loves, and still has David's car, this red car, and he decides to drive to Chicago. So I don't know really much about American geography. Is that far? I have no clue.
I would think that it's like, depending on where you are in Minnesota, you have to go through Wisconsin, but it's not too far. It's probably like, it's within a day drive.
My theory is that if he had been near San Diego, he might have gone there next after Norman. I think Norman is protected by his geographic distance. But anyway, he drives up to Chicago, he parks the red car, and he goes to the house of a very wealthy real estate developer called Lee Miglin, who's 72 years old. And he's like super, super wealthy, has this amazing house with like very expensive cars and clothes and everything that Andrew would love. And his wife, Marilyn Miglin, is apparently like back in the day, she had this really famous skincare line and beauty line and would always like hawk it on Home Shopping Network. So she was really famous. And they apparently have a 40-year very loving marriage and they have kids. But the wife's away for the weekend. Andrew goes into the Miglin house, to the 72-year-old's house. They proceed apparently to go to the car garage, and Lee Miglin has his feet bound together. He has his head taped over to mimic a latex mask so that he can't breathe. He has his face brutally punched in.
Jesus.
He has concrete, sacks of kind of powdered concrete that are in the garage, pounded onto his chest to break every single rib. And then he's stabbed 20 times with a screwdriver, and his throat is sawn open with a hacksaw. So
Jesus Christ.
It is a brutal murder.
Was Andrew just like, we were playing?
Andrew then basically
this is
puts,
S&M?
He then puts women's underwear on Lee Miglin and puts like really extreme gay porn around him. And then, this is the weirdest bit, he then goes into the house, eats some Haagen-Dazs, eats a ham, goes and has a bath, cuts his hair, sleeps overnight, steals some of Lee's very expensive clothes, steals some like very special gold coins from his safe, so he evidently knows the key to the safe, nicks the Lexus and rides off.
Wait a minute, what is going on with his wife?
The wife then comes back on after the business trip and you know, with the neighbors, finds Lee dead. So this is fascinating to me because
I'm reading about this right now and it doesn't seem right.
There is no hard evidence that Andrew knew Lee at all, but there are some eyewitness accounts, and you know how unreliable eyewitnesses are, that Lee was closeted gay and that he used gay escorts and he may have met Andrew that way. And therefore, Andrew did know where he lived and he knew about the safe and he had some familiarity with the house. But the family to this day maintain that Lee Miglin was not gay, that he'd never met Andrew, and that it was quote unquote a random act of violence.
All right, Bina, listen to this. Chicago Sun-Times columnist Irv Kapusinet, a friend of Miglin's, added another puzzling aspect to the case today. He reported that, visiting the Miglin home, he was surprised to be confronted by a barking, growling dog. When he asked where the dog was during the crime, Kapusinet said that Marilyn Miglin shrugged her shoulders and said, "Do you want to buy a large dog?"
She was very criticized because she wasn't seen as being a weeping widow and she was back on Home Shopping Network selling stuff.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like, right?
But, you know, I kind of like feel, having read Gone Girl, actually, that, you know, you shouldn't judge people's reactions. Like, everyone reacts differently. And, you know, the tabloid media, because this is when this case became tabloid fodder and Fox News is there, because these guys were hugely politically connected and important. And I just feel that kind of judginess of victims' families, I find really distasteful. But I do think it's kind of interesting that in all three cases, these were closeted gay men who were killed, and it kind of feels like Andrew was in sort of quite a vicious way, particularly trying to out Lee. And, you know, I of course think people should be out and proud and be happy to be who they are, but there's something really nasty in that, the way that was done, as well as the murder, right? So,
but still, we're just, there's, it doesn't look like there's any evidence that he was gay besides being found surrounded by gay porn.
It's kind of interesting because Maureen Orth, who writes for Vanity Fair and upon whose book the American Crime Story series is based, says that she has numerous witnesses who say that they knew each other and that Lee Miglin used gay escorts, but there's no concrete evidence. And I kind of feel that, I don't know, I have mixed ethical questions about this because in the TV show, it's very much that they knew each other and he's definitely gay. And I kind of feel like, I don't know if we should be kind of retrospectively trying to out people without evidence. And I just think it's really harsh on the family, but then there is homophobia there and that's wrong. And I don't know. It's a tough one.
It's shocking, like in every aspect, because you're getting all this information and it's just like, you know, it shouldn't be shocking that he was gay, but the fact that like now he's dead and he was leading this secret life that he hid from everyone, like, it just really tarnishes the memory of him, too.
I just feel bad for the family. I mean, I feel bad for him. I mean, what a way, like, just such a legacy.
Sure.
You know, it's just brutal. And even for, you know, the families of David and Jeff Trail, like, it's just horrific. I really think it's horrific on so many levels. So we now have Andrew, who's gone from killing the people he loves to maybe killing... I mean, maybe he went and asked him for money so he could, I don't know why he decided, or maybe he's just enjoyed the two first killings and wants to, because this is the first killing where there's some kind of like S&M aspect with the binding of the face and
right.
All that stuff.
I'm wondering maybe like, you know, like there's like very, how do I say this kind of politically correctly? There's communities of people that share certain sexual interests.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if that's how they were, how they, like, quote, knew each other. Like,
yeah.
Through these communities. Like, maybe never had met, but, like, had shared videos or...
Whatever, yeah. At any rate, I don't know.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, it just doesn't seem like, when you get into the real, and we're not doing that, obviously, we're doing a sort of a Volopy format, so it's a bit quick. But when you get into a deep detail dive on how he entered the property and what he did when he was there, it just feels to me... probable that he knew this man and knew the layout of the property and had been there before, because it doesn't seem random to me. And if it's not random, the only way they can have known each other is through being a gay escort. Now, that might have been very plain vanilla sex, or not even sex at all, just companionship.
Yeah.
But it's...
Well, he did have a ham sandwich, apparently.
I just feel bad for Lee Miglin. I think it's just such a brutal way to... These were all brutal murders, in fairness.
But he's going on quite a little spree here. This is like
a spree killer. He's not a serial killer. He's a spree killer.
Yeah.
So now, from Chicago, he's got the very flashy car. This flashy car in 1997, I didn't even know this was a thing, has a car phone in it that's automatically activated when you turn on the ignition.
Oh, sure. I think I had a cell phone maybe later. But yeah, I mean, in the 90s, the car phones were like, they came in the like with the little suitcases, too.
I had no idea. We didn't have those in England because we're poor and behind.
Oh, yeah. Well, you're sending car smoke signals.
Yeah, exactly. So basically,
no,
I'm
pretty sure, like, Motorola Tech phones were already out, and I think my friends had them in high school. I know my one friend Meredith definitely did.
Okay.
Okay, anyway.
So at this point, he drives to New York, does a bit of shopping, hangs out. He thinks he's fine. But the police are tracking him, and they can track him not like precisely, but to wherever the beacon is that picks up the pings.
Right.
And there's a leak, and Andrew hears on the radio that the police are tracking him. Oh. At this point, he's driving through New Jersey, so he tries to like rip out the phone from the car, but he can't figure out where in the trunk is the actual signal coming from. So he needs a new car.
So
he pulls into Finns Point National Cemetery, where caretaker William Reese, family man, father, good, just basically a good guy. He likes doing military reenactments. He's just a homemaker. He's just a decent stand-up guy.
Sure,
45
sure.
years old.
Not anymore.
He goes into his caretaker's house, gets the keys, tells William Reese to go into the basement, makes him ill, and shoots him in the back of the head. Takes the car. So, I mean, this poor schmo, just like, wrong time, wrong place.
Yeah, that's going to be his new nickname.
So at this point, there's a, you know, after Chicago, there's like a nationwide manhunt, APBs out. And actually, one of the FBI people does say, oh, he's doing, is it Adama who went down to Florida?
Was it Dahmer?
Mm.
I don't know. I don't,
yeah, one
I
of
don't
the famous
think I remember that happening.
Yeah, they did that kind of same New York down the kids thing. Anyway, up until this point, the police have been really uninterested, as have the FBI, in doing any kind of behavioral profiling, in kind of linking these as being kind of gay murders in particular. I think actually that comes out of earnestness, like not wanting to kind of, I think it's like an anti-homophobia thing, bizarrely. Like they don't want to make it to be a gay thing because they don't want to kind of like tarnish the gay community as, you know, being particularly violent or whatever.
Right.
So that's a good thing. But I think it does kind of mean that they're not really getting into the nitty-gritty of what was his life in San Diego and who does he know and who's he obsessed with, etc. Because if he's going down to Florida, which he is, he ends up in Miami Beach and he stays there for a good amount of time. I mean, I think he kills William Reese, like he kills Miglin on May the 4th. He kills William Reese shortly thereafter. But he's in Miami for all of June and a bit of July too. Kind of just
hiding. Those are hot months down there.
Hiding in plain sight. And the problem is by this point, the FBI like has flyers showing his face, but it's pictures of when he's younger and preppier, but they just don't give them out. And what a lot of people say, and what's in the book by Maureen Orth, is that because it's such a condensed gay community, like everybody knows everyone there, that if you've put up some flyers, someone would have seen him and handed him in. But no one
yeah.
knew. No one
I think,
knew.
I don't know if you've ever been to South Beach, but it seems like it has a very tight gay community down there. Like a very, like, I don't think they would have said anything.
But at least they should have been warned.
Yeah.
At least they should have been warned, I feel, very strongly. And I guess what the police say is they didn't want to cause a panic, which I also get, but I just feel, you know, better to have a panic than not. And it just strikes me as, I think he would have been picked up if they had been more willing to put themselves out there as police people. And actually, one of the kind of results of this whole thing is the FBI did actually admit that they hadn't been good at cultivating close ties with the gay community and that they were distrusted by them, and the FBI needed to do better in cultivating those ties so that when something like this happens, you do have community leaders that you can reach out to who trust you and that you can help to keep people safe, right?
Right. I mean, that was like the FBI's MO under Hoover, is like, we have information that you are a homosexual and
we're going to
target
you.
This, yeah, exactly. So,
yeah.
Of course, they have a bad relationship with them.
So, I mean, the FBI almost immediately kind of were like apologetic, but it is what it is. But I think it's almost both for probably negative reasons and indeed for positive kind of earnest reasons. It was just very badly handled. I mean, the fact that he's there for 6 weeks, he's on the FBI's most wanted, 10 most wanted list. And
he made the list.
He made the list.
Huh.
Following the murder of Reese, he makes the list. Was it following the murder of Miglin? I think following the murder of Miglin, he makes the list.
Sure.
But he's able to hide for 6 weeks in Florida. And, like, this is the hilarious bit. He goes to a pawn shop and he hands in the gold, this very specific gold medallion coin thing that he'd nicked from Lee Miglin. He pawns it. He gives his genuine real ID, which is unusual because he's been using fake IDs. But he gives his actual genuine one. The pawn shop owner, as is her duty when it's over a certain amount, takes the information, the passport scan, and gives it to the police because you have to. And they just never check it. They would have found him immediately.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, like, this is like one example. There are many examples of missed opportunities to have caught this guy.
All right, so who's next?
On July 15th, 1997, it's the morning. The Italian fashion designer Gianni Versace has just left his beautiful Miami mansion to go buy a newspaper.
I've
Coming back
seen
to the
it too. It really is
house, he's
beautiful.
unlocking the door to get back in, and he's shot point blank range by Andrew Cannon. Andrew Cannon then just calmly walks down Ocean Drive.
Huh.
His car is still in the parking garage, and he's 8 days later still in hiding, and no one's found him.
But the police know that Versace was shot
Oh yeah,
already,
I mean
or
they know
okay.
immediately, like the police, the press. I mean
Oh.
there's literally like weirdos like picking up his blood spatter from the pavement to keep it.
No
The
way.
whole thing is sordid. It's so sordid.
So did I mean I know that Giovanni Versace was gay, but was he did he know Andrew? Was there any connection there, or was he just like a gay public figure that
So there's two stories, and it's very similar to the Lee Miglin case, that there are people who saw Andrew Cannon back in the day meet Gianni Versace in a nightclub on the West Coast. Versace was over designing costumes for the opera, and apparently he was in a VIP area of a nightclub, and a friend of a friend introduced them, and Versace was like, "Yeah, okay, hi, nice to meet you, and fuck off, I don't know you." Which Andrew then spun into a tale of how they went for dinner and blah blah blah. The problem
Oh
is that
no.
Andrew is like a huge fantasist, so how much do you believe? But it does
Right.
appear to be independently verified. So I feel that there's more chance that he'd met Versace back in the day than Lee Miglin. But I feel that it wasn't like as an escort. I think it was just a sort of a chance kind of high in a VIP area. Like if you kind of like awkwardly foist yourself upon a star and then get brushed aside by security sort of thing. But he
Yeah.
had, ever since he was, a preppy, idolized Versace as, basically the guy who had what he wanted, which is the lifestyle, the kind of designer clothes, the super success, being out and proud, having love because he had a long-term partner. It was just someone for him to both idolize but envy. And I think this, the sin of Andrew Cannon is covetousness. He's very jealous and envious and turns it into
And
violence.
murdery. Yeah.
So he may or may not have known him. What is interesting, however, is a bit like Lee Miglin, that while Versace or Donatella Versace was open about the fact that her brother was gay, apparently, according to Maureen Orth, the autopsy showed that he was HIV positive. But the
Oh
family
no.
has always denied this because at the time they were thinking of taking the company public, and they thought that would hurt the brand. So they
So
kind of.
was he did so did Versace have AIDS? I mean
Well, apparently the autopsy shows this, and Maureen Orth says that he was, but we don't see it. Like, we don't have a document that shows it, right?
Gotcha.
So it's, do you believe the Vanity Fair journalist? Family denies it. I don't think it really matters. I mean, I think it's kind of like the reason this is also controversial in the TV show, because in the TV show they say that he was, because Ryan Murphy says that he wants to take away any shame from that diagnosis. Like, why would you
Right.
deny it if you were? And I'm kind of like, yeah, I get that. Like, I totally agree. It's not shameful at all. But the
And this is
point is, like, we don't have
97.
proof, though. So it's kind of like, I don't know.
But this is 97, and it's, I mean, obviously it still had a stigma, but it's like, there was a good drug regimen out there where it was a very, survivable
Much more
disease to
livable world,
have.
right? Yeah.
Yeah.
But fashion designers who'd come out who'd had AIDS were obviously saw, so I don't think he had AIDS actually, I think he was just HIV positive. But
Oof.
if
And
he
those
was.
people are collecting samples of his blood off the sidewalk? Oof.
Good luck to them, yeah. I know. The whole thing is just ridiculous. I mean, this became a total zoo. It was a total post OJ zoo, and I think if it weren't for the death of Princess Diana 2 weeks later, it would have continued to be, but then it was like the even greater tragedy and scandal. But yeah.
He's got to steal that from us.
So, Versace's dead. 8 days later, we don't really know what happened to Andrew Cannon at this point. I mean, the whole time he's been in Miami, which is now 2 months, he's been turning tricks for money for crystal meth, shooting up, living in a really dingy motel room, just basically a shadow of this private schoolboy kept by Norman,
So
living
does
alone.
Andrew have AIDS yet?
No, and this was really interesting. At one point, the FBI was spinning a theory that maybe it was that Andrew had gotten AIDS and was therefore like in a revenge killing spree against the people he thought might have given it to him.
That makes sense.
Yeah,
but no, again, he's also using IV drugs and having gay sex. I'm assuming unprotected, but maybe protected, but even still, it's very high-risk behavior.
Exactly. But no, he was actually HIV negative, ironically enough. But again, it shows, like, homophobia. Like, it was kind of like this... It was very easy, I feel, for law enforcement at the time to make it out to be some sort of tawdry, gay, sort of love triangle, sexual fetish stuff. I mean, it was, for mainstream police enforcement, it was very easy for them to sneer at it, maybe. And you would read stuff in the contemporary press, which was kind of like, well, you know, Versace brought it on himself because, you know, he's living in South Beach and, you know, it's just an unsafe. If you choose to have that lifestyle, it's unsafe. So you get what you deserve.
Yeah, that's bullshit. I mean, because at the same time,
it's so unpleasant. It's so disgusting. And
at the same time, the president of the United States is getting a blowjob in the Oval Office, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, the mainstream society has nothing to feel morally superior about at this point. So yeah, the whole thing is just horrible. And even like the distribution of the flyers, I think it was just too easy to say, we don't have any ins with the gay community and that's going to be hard and take work to get them to trust us. And you know what, the flyers won't really do anything because they won't tell us anyway. So let's just leave them in the back of the car. And it's like, you know that there's a guy who's targeting gay or, you know, apart from Reese, which is a crime of opportunity, people. You know that he's heading in this direction. He's targeted a high-profile guy named Miglin. Maybe you want to warn Gianni Versace? Like, at this point, like, high-profile gay people are getting bodyguards.
Yeah.
Like, David Geffen, because they thought that maybe some of the West Coast gay, like, high-profile gay community would be targeted, like Norman. Steven Spielberg is telling Dave Geffen, get a bodyguard. And he's like, I've lived in Malibu 20 years. I'm not doing that. But, you know, like, this is serious. Like, should someone not have warned Versace, I feel?
Yeah, I mean...
And Norman at this point is ringing up the FBI to try and help them and telling them about his obsessions, which include Versace and the stories of meeting him. And the FBI being very dismissive. And I feel Norman, for this high-profile businessman on the West Coast, who I don't think was closeted, but still, I mean, he really put himself out there to try and help. So I feel law enforcement didn't do their shit. Anyway, 8 days later, to end the tale, Andrew Kanana, we don't know why, he kills himself... He shoots himself to the right temple in a houseboat in Miami Beach.
That's fucking bullshit. You know what? Like, and I know, like, whatever. Just kill yourself.
He did.
And everyone else. No, but why did he have to go and kill other people? Like, just do it. I mean, if you need to go, you need to go. That's fine. Why'd you have to take everyone else out with you?
Well, it's narcissism, isn't it?
Yeah, but still, it's bullshit. If you need to go, don't kill other people and don't jump in front of trains that ruin my commute. That, two things.
I mean, I don't think he wanted it. I mean, I think he wanted what he wanted. And when he was denied it by Jeff and David, my personal belief is that the first crime was a crime of passion. The second one was a crime of kind of disappointment that or delusion that David wasn't going to run off with him and live a new life. So again, kind of like a crime of passion. I think the third crime... David and Jeff is the first two. I think they were crimes of
Miglin,
passion. Miglin, I think, is a crime of covetousness. I think once he realized... I think Jeff and David are crimes of passion, and he realizes that his dreams of this life and this love is gone. And then he's angry, and he wants to punish people who he believes have lived lives where they have achieved what he hasn't. And Lee Miglin and Gianni Versace are super successful, super rich. They have the suave, sophisticated life he wants, and he wants to destroy it. And poor William Reese is just some, you know, bumblefuck schmo who gets caught in the chase. But I think these are genuine crimes of, like, materialism.
But, I mean, even still, Miglin, I mean... This is the first time I've ever heard his name, so I'm guessing, like, there's a number of rich people in Chicago that he could have gotten, like, so maybe that gives him more credence that, because, I mean, obviously Versace's out and proud and very successful. Like, I don't understand the Miglin tie unless, like, you do look into either sexuality or, you know, sexual preferences with the S&M kind of stuff.
Exactly. Because, Andrew's not stupid. He's an intelligent guy, and he does seem to be motivated. So it just seems like a random act of violence is not what this was about. Even though, as I said, to be fair, the Miglin family and the Versace family claim Andrew had never met Gianni.
Either of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Meanwhile, they might, like you said, they may have like said hi at one time at some event, and then, you know, Andrew thinks that like, oh yeah, no, they had like a long, meaningful conversation and they're best buds.
Mm. But it's incredibly sad because he's a bright boy. I think his parents have raised him. I mean, you probably have some kind of narcissistic gene in you, but they've raised him to really exploit that character trait. And God knows how or why he turned violent. But it's also interesting to me because he's not a serial killer. It is a spree, and they are quite different, aren't they? Like the first and third are very brutal, like personally brutal.
Mm-hmm.
The third one's the only one that has a lot of sexual element to it in terms of the binding of the face and the way in which the homosexual materials are laid out.
Mm-hmm.
The second and the fifth are just gunshots, and indeed himself. Like it's not like a typical serial killer where you see a pattern develop and get more and more.
Second, fourth, and fifth, right? Because the poor wrong place.
Exactly. Second, fourth, and fifth.
Yeah, the hammer is definitely like, you know, like they say, like, that's something very personal and brutal, and to do it 27 times, that's like deeply
horrific.
Yeah.
That's also interesting to me because, you know, I was alive in a teenager during this period at university even, and like I knew about the assassination of Gianni Versace, but I just never knew the name of who did it, and I didn't know it was part of a spree killing thing. And I think it's probably because, especially living in England at the time, when Diana dies, that just blocks out everything else from the media.
Right.
So it's only through American Crime Story, the series, which I would heartily recommend, and Maureen Orth's book, which I just read, that which I would also heartily recommend, it's called Vulgar Favours, that I got to know this story. And I actually think that Andrew Cunanan is a, you know, the first half of the book is her just describing the childhood and what the parents did, and I think it's really fascinating. And I think for anyone out there who's a parent, I mean, it's really fascinating that you can be too good to your kids. You can, that's as unbalancing and as emotionally unhealthy as being too strict and nasty and bullying.
Oh sure.
And also because I think it's so credible to me to be the poor kid in school and just try and fantasize that your parents are as rich and aren't as embarrassingly, you know, it starts off as so something I can sympathize with so very much, but then it takes this turn, you know, as you get into the crystal meth and the increasingly unhinged behavior into the violence, and you just think this is horrific and I want nothing to do with you, and you just wonder what is it that takes this super smart, quite sweet, but, you know, slightly delusional boy and turns him into that. And it's yeah, I find it fascinating.
Wow. Well, that was very interesting.
You have been bullet.
What is the takeaway? What is there any moral to the story? Like in the show, did like the FBI decide to reach out to the gay community more? Or...
Well, the show's still running. The show has 3 out of 9 episodes still to go. But the moral was immediately actually that the FBI did start to reach out to the gay community more. I think the moral for us as people is sometimes it's healthy to tell your children no and not give them everything. And sometimes it's healthy when you know that people around you are just like lying horrifically to call them out on it.
Yeah.
Cruel to be kind.
So ACS has done, what, Menendez Brothers and OJ?
Yeah.
Versace.
Actually, was Menendez ACS? I think Menendez was a different one.
Oh, no. Menendez was like Law and Order.
Special, yeah. I want to say SVU, but yeah. That was a different franchise. Although still good. I mean, both of those are good. OJ was definitely better than Menendez. This is stunning. I mean, some of the way it's photographed, like they do an episode which is very much like the movie American Gigolo. It has shades of Patrick Bateman and American Psycho.
Oh,
it
Jesus.
He really reminds me of Tom Ripley. The poor kid with the rich friends who wants that lifestyle. He's an inveterate liar. Talented Mr. Ripley.
Okay. I never saw that.
Yeah. Very much like a Patricia Highsmith character.
So I remember going down to Miami for the millennium, the New Year's Eve millennium, and being on South Beach and seeing Versace's mansion, and it's amazing. Like that old like Spanish Mediterranean colonial like hacienda. Oh my God. That's like, I'd love to live there.
It's stunning. It is stunning. But anyway, I guess we should close out the episode. I think we should say this is in memory of, you know, the victims, which is not just the people who died. It's the families who had to endure everything that came out afterwards. It's an incredibly sad and wasteful story, and particularly for William Reese, just horrific. Gianni Versace, we were robbed of a great talent. But all of the victims, I'm sure, were very important and special in their own lives.
Yeah.
And it's horrid.
Yeah.
So on that downer of a note, thank you very much for joining me, Matt, and thank you very much for lurking, Jock. It's been a pleasure. Yeah.